Jeg er nu Rath, Yggdrasils, Eas Elgrim, for Aes Dunor, Ugras, og Skrond, Aesdæ, Abelia, Yggdrasils, Uramun, Aya, Zro.
Welcome to this, the 72nd of the Cthulhu Podcasts. As usual today, we'll have a segment of Through the Brazilian Wilderness by Teddy Roosevelt. We'll follow that up with some 20s music, and then the show will finish with the main feature being the next segment of H.P. Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, Part 36. 5 days after leaving us, the launch, with one of the native trading boats lashed alongside, returned. On the 13th, we broke camp, loaded ourselves and all our belongings on the launch and the houseboat, and started upstream for Tapirapoan. All told, there were about 30 men, with 5 dogs and tents, bedding and provisions, fresh beef, growing rapidly less fresh, skins, all and everything jammed together. It rained most of the first day, and part of the first night. After that, the weather was generally overcast and pleasant for travelling, but sometimes rain and torrid sunshine alternated. The cooking, and it was good cooking, was done at a funny little open-air fireplace, with 2 or 3 cooking pots placed at the stern of the houseboat. The fireplace was a platform of earth, taken from anthills, and heaped and spread on the boards of the boat. Around it the dusky cook worked with philosophic solemnity, in rain and shine. Our attendants, friendly souls with skins of every shade and hue, slept most of the time curled up among boxes, bundles, and slabs of beef. An enormous land turtle was tethered towards the bow of the houseboat. When the men slept too near it, it made futile efforts to scramble over them, and in return now and then one of them gravely used it as a seat. Slowly the throbbing engine drove the launch and its unwieldy side partner against the swift current. The river had risen. We made about 1.5 miles an hour. Ahead of us the brown water street stretched in curves between endless walls of dense tropical forest. It was like passing through a gigantic greenhouse. Wawasa and burity palms, cricropias, huge figs, feathery bamboos, strange yellow-stemmed trees, low trees with enormous leaves, tall trees with foliage as delicate as lace, trees with buttressed trunks, trees with boles rising smooth and straight to lofty heights, all woven together by a tangle of vines, crowded down to the edge of the river. Their drooping branches hung down to the water, forming a screen through which it was impossible to see the bank, and exceedingly difficult to penetrate to the bank. Rarely one of them showed flowers, large white blossoms or small red and yellow blossoms. More often, the lilac flowers of the begonia vine made large patches of colour. Innumerable epiphytes covered the limbs, and even grew on the roughened trunks. We saw little bird life, a darter now and then, and kingfishers flitting from perch to perch. At long intervals we passed a ranch. At one, the large, red-tiled, whitewashed house stood on a grassy slope behind mango trees. The wooden shutters were thrown back from the unglazed windows, and the big rooms were utterly bare. Not a book, not an ornament. A palm loaded with scores of pendulous nests of the troupials stood near the door. Behind were orange trees and coffee plants, and nearby fields of bananas, rice, and tobacco. The sallow foreman was courteous and hospitable. His dark-skinned womenfolk kept in the furtive background. Like most of the ranches, it was owned by a company with headquarters at Caceres. The trip was pleasant and interesting, although there was not much to do on the boat. It was too crowded to move around, save with a definite purpose. We enjoyed the scenery, we talked in English, Portuguese, bad French, and broken German. Some of us wrote. Fiala made sketches of improved tents, hammocks, and other field equipment, suggested by what he had already seen. Some of us read books. Colonel Rondon, neat, trim, alert, and soldierly, studied a standard work on applied geographical astronomy. Father Zam read a novel by Fogazzario. Kermit read Camões and a couple of Brazilian novels, O Garari and Inocentia. My own reading varied from Quentin Durward and Gibson to the Chancy de Roland. Miller took out his little pet owl Moses from a basket in which Moses dwelt, and gave him food and water. Moses crooned and chuckled gratefully when he was stroked and tickled. Late the first evening we moored to the bank by a little fazenda of the poorer type. The houses were of palm leaves. Even the walls were made up of huge fronds or leafy branches of the wasara palm, stuck upright in the ground, with the blades plaited together. Some of us went ashore, some stayed on the boats. There were no mosquitoes, the weather was not oppressively hot, and we slept well. By 5 o'clock the next morning, we had each drunk a cup of delicious Brazilian coffee, and the boats were under way. All day we steamed slowly upstream. We passed two or three fazendas. At one, where we halted to get milk, the trees were overgrown with pretty little yellow orchids. At dark we moored at a spot where there were no branches to prevent our placing the boats directly alongside the bank. There were hardly any mosquitoes. Most of the party took their hammocks ashore, and the camp was pitched amid singularly beautiful surroundings. The trees were wasara palms, some with the fronds cresting very tall trunks, some with the fronds, seemingly longer, rising almost from the ground. The fronds were of great length, some could not have been less than 50 feet long. Bushes and tall grass, dew-drenched and glittering with the green of emeralds, grew in the open spaces between. We left at sunrise the following morning. One of the sailors had strayed inland. He got turned round and could not find the river, and we started before discovering his absence. We stopped at once, and with much difficulty he forced his way through the vine-laced and thorn-guarded jungle towards the sound of the launch's engines and of the bugle which was blown. In this dense jungle, when the sun is behind the clouds, a man without a compass who strays 100 yards from the river may readily become hopelessly lost. As we ascended the river, the wawasa palms became constantly more numerous. At this point, for many miles, they gave their own character to the forest on the river banks. Everywhere their long curving fronds rose among the other trees, and in places their lofty trunks made them hold their heads higher than the other trees. But they were never as tall as the giants among ordinary trees. On one towering palm we noticed a mass of beautiful violet orchids growing from the side of the trunk, halfway to the top. On another big tree, not a palm, which stood in a little opening, there were hung well over 100 troupial nests. Besides two or three of the small ranches, we this day passed a large ranch. The various houses and sheds, all palm-thatched, stood by the river in a big space of cleared ground, dotted with wawasa palms. A native houseboat was moored by the bank. Women and children looked from the unglazed windows of the houses. Men stood in front of them. The biggest house was enclosed by a stockade of palm logs thrust end-on into the ground. Cows and oxen grazed round and about. The carts, with solid wheels, each wheel made of a single disc of wood, were tilted on their poles. Today's music is a 1928 track by Blind Willie McTell, called Statesboro Blues.
Wake up, mama, turn your lamp down low. Wake up, mama, turn your lamp down low. Have you got the nerve to drive Papa McTell from your door? My mother, daddy left me reckless. My daddy left me wild. Mother, daddy left me reckless. Daddy left me wild. No, I'm not good looking, but I'm some sweet woman's angel child. She's a mighty mean woman. Do me this away. She's a mighty mean woman. Do me this away. When I leave this town, pretty mama, I'm gonna wait to stay. Why's love a woman better than anyone I'd ever seen? I once loved a woman better than anyone I'd ever seen. Treated me like I'm a king and she was a doggone queen. Sister, tell your brother. Brother, tell your auntie. Now, auntie, tell your uncle. Uncle, tell my cousin. Now, cousin, tell my friend. Going up the country. Mama, don't you want to go? May take me a fair brown. May take one or two more. Big 80 left Savannah. Blowing it did not stop. You oughta saw that color farming. When he got them bottle hot, you can reach over in the corner, mama, and hand me my traveling shoes. You know by that I've got them States Fair blues. Mama, sister got them. Daddy got them. Brother got them. Friend got them. I got them. I woke up this morning, we had them States Fair blues. I looked over in the corner, grandma and grandpa had them too.
And now on to our main feature. Chapter 5. A Nightmare and a Cataclysm. Part 1. And now swiftly followed that hideous experience which has left its indelible mark of fear on the soul of Marinus Bicknell Willett, and has added a decade to the visible age of one whose youth was even then far behind. Dr. Willett had conferred at length with Mr. Ward, and had come to an agreement with him on several points which both felt the alienists would ridicule. There was, they conceded, a terrible movement alive in the world, whose direct connection with a necromancy even older than the Salem witchcraft could not be doubted. That at least two living men, and one other of whom they dared not think, were in absolute possession of minds of personalities which had functioned as early as 1690 or before, was likewise almost unassailably proved, even in the face of all known natural laws. What these horrible creatures, and Charles Ward as well, were doing or trying to do, seemed fairly clear from the letters and from every bit of light, both old and new, which had filtered in upon the case. They were robbing the tombs of all the ages, including those of the world's wisest and greatest men, in the hope of recovering from the bygone ashes some vestige of the consciousness and lore which had once animated and informed them. A hideous traffic was going on amongst these nightmarish ghouls, whereby illustrious bones were bartered with the calm calculativeness of schoolboys swapping books, and from what was extorted from this centuried dust, there was anticipated a power and a wisdom beyond anything which the cosmos had seen concentrated in one man or group. They had found unholy ways to keep their brains alive, either in the same body or different bodies, and had evidently achieved a way of tapping the consciousness of the dead whom they gathered together. There had, it seems, been some truth in the Shimerial or Baralis, when he wrote of preparing from even the most antique remains certain essential salts, from which the shade of a long-dead living thing might be raised up. There was a formula for evoking a shade, and another for putting it down, and it had now been so perfected that it could be taught successfully. One must be careful about evocations, for the markers of old graves are not always accurate. Willett and Mr. Ward shivered as they passed from conclusion to conclusion. Things, presences or voices of some sort, could be drawn down from unknown places as well as from the grave, and in this process also one must be careful. Joseph Kirwan had indubitably evoked many forbidden things, and as for Charles, what might one think of him? What forces outside the spheres had reached him from Joseph Kirwan's day and turned his mind on forgotten things? He had been led to find certain directions, and he had used them. He had talked with the man of horror in Prague, and stayed long with the creatures in the mountains of Transylvania, and he must have found the grave of Joseph Kirwan at last. That newspaper item and what his mother had heard in the night were too significant to overlook. Then he had summoned something, and it must have come. That mighty voice aloft Good Friday, and those different tones in the locked attic laboratory. What were they like, with their depth and hollowness? Was there not here some awful foreshadowing of the dreaded stranger Dr. Allen with his spectral bass? Yes, that was what Mr. Ward had felt with vague horror in his single talk with the man, if man it were, over the telephone. What hellish consciousness or voice, what morbid shade or presence had come to answer Charles Ward's secret rites behind that locked door? Those voices heard in argument. Must have it read for 3 months? Good God! Was that not just before the vampirism broke out? The rifling of Ezra Whedon's ancient grave, and the cries later at poor Tuxit. Whose mind had planned the vengeance and rediscovered the shunned seat of elder blasphemies? And then the bungalow and the bearded stranger and the gossip and the fear. the final madness of Charles neither father nor doctor could attempt to explain. But they did feel sure that the mind of Joseph Kirwan had come to earth again and was following its ancient morbidities. Was demonic possession in truth a possibility? Alan had something to do with it, and the detectives must find out more about one whose existence menaced the young man's life. In the meantime, since the existence of some vast crypt beneath the bungalow seemed virtually beyond dispute, some effort must be made to find it. Willett and Mr. Ward, conscious of the sceptical attitude of the alienists, resolved during their final conference to undertake a joint secret exploration of unparalleled thoroughness, and agreed to meet at the bungalow on the following morning with valises and with certain tools and accessories suited to architectural search and underground exploration. The morning of April 6th dawned clear, and both explorers were at the bungalow by 10 o'clock. Mr. Ward had the key, and an entry and cursory survey was made. From the disordered condition of Dr. Allen's room, it was obvious that the detectives had been there before, and the later searchers hoped that they had found some clue which might prove of value. Of course, the main business lay in the cellar, so thither they descended without much delay, again making the circuit which each had vainly made before in the presence of the mad young owner. For a time everything seemed baffling, each inch of the earthen floor and stone walls having so solid and innocuous an aspect that the thought of a yearning aperture was scarcely to be entertained. Willett reflected that since the original cellar was dug without knowledge of any catacombs beneath, the beginning of the passage would represent the strictly modern delving of young Ward and his associates, where they had probed for the ancient vaults, whose rumour must have reached them by no wholesome means. The doctor tried to put himself in Charles's place, to see how a delver would be likely to start, but could not gain much inspiration from this method. Then he decided on elimination as a policy, and went carefully over the whole subterranean surface, both vertical and horizontal, trying to account for every inch separately. He was soon substantially narrowed down, and at last had nothing left but the small platform beneath the washtubs, which he tried once before in vain. Now, experimenting in every possible way, and exerting a double strength, he finally found that the top did indeed turn and slide horizontally on a corner pivot. Beneath it lay a trim concrete surface with an iron manhole, to which Mr. Ward at once rushed with excited zeal. The cover was not hard to lift, and the father had quite removed it when Willett noticed the queerness of his aspect. He was swaying and nodding dizzily, and in the gust of noxious air which swept up from the black pit beneath, the doctor soon recognised ample cause. In a moment Dr. Willett had his fainting companion on the floor above and was reviving him with cold water. Mr. Ward responded feebly, but it could be seen that the mephitic blast from the crypt had in some way gravely sickened him. Wishing to take no chances, Willett hastened out to Broad Street for a taxicab and had soon dispatched the sufferer home, despite his weak-voiced protests. After which he produced an electric torch, covered his nostrils with a band of sterile gauze, and descended once more to peer into the new-found depths. The foul air had now slightly abated, and Willett was able to send a beam of light down the Stygian hold. For about 10 feet he saw it was a sheer cylindrical drop, with concrete walls and an iron ladder, after which the hole appeared to strike a flight of old stone steps, which must originally have emerged to earth somewhere south-west of the present building. Part 2. Willett freely admits that for a moment the memory of the old Kirwan legends kept him from climbing down alone into that malodorous gulf. He could not help thinking of what Fenner had reported on that last monstrous night. Then duty asserted itself, and he made the plunge. Carrying a great valise for the removal of whatever papers might prove of supreme importance, slowly, as befitted one of his years, he descended the ladder and reached the slimy steps below. There was ancient masonry, his torch told him, and upon the dripping walls he saw the unwholesome moss of centuries. Down, down ran the steps, not spirally, but in three abrupt turns, and with such narrowness that two men could have passed only with difficulty. He had counted about 30 when a sound reached him very faintly, and after that he did not feel disposed to count any more. It was a godless sound, one of those low-keyed, insidious outrages of nature which are not meant to be. To call it a dull wail, a doom-dragged whine, or a hopeless howl of chorused anguish and stricken flesh without mind would be to miss its quintessential loathsomeness and soul-sickening overtones. Was it for this that Ward had seemed to listen on that day he was removed? It was the most shocking thing that Willett had ever heard, and it continued from no determinate point as the doctor reached the bottom of the steps and cast his torchlight around on lofty corridor walls surmounted by cyclopean vaulting and pierced by numberless black archways. The hall in which he stood was perhaps 14 feet high in the middle of the vaulting and 10 or 12 feet broad. Its pavement was of large chipped flagstones, and its walls and roof were of dressed masonry. Its length he could not determine, for it stretched ahead indefinitely into the blackness. Of the archways, some had doors of the old six-panelled colonial type, while others had none. Overcoming the dread induced by the smell and the howling, Willett began to explore these archways one by one, finding beyond them rooms with groined stone ceilings, each of medium size and apparently of bizarre use. Most of them had fireplaces, the upper courses of whose chimneys would have formed an interesting study in engineering. Never before or since had he seen such instruments, or suggestions of instruments, as here loomed up on every hand through the burying dust and cobwebs of a century and a half, in many cases evidently shattered as if by the ancient raiders. For many of the chambers seemed wholly untrodden by modern feet, and must have represented the earliest and most obsolete phases of Joseph Curwen's experimentation. Finally, there came a room of obvious modernity, or at least of recent occupancy. There were oil heaters, bookshelves and tables, chairs and cabinets, and a desk piled high with papers of varying antiquity and of contemporaneousness. Candlesticks and oil lamps stood about in several places, and finding a match safe handy, Willett lighted such as were ready for use. In the fuller gleam, it appeared that this apartment was nothing less than the latest study and library of Charles Ward. Of the books, the doctor had seen many before, and a good part of the furniture had plainly come from the Prospect Street mansion. Here and there was a piece well known to Willett, and the sense of familiarity became so great that he half forgot the noisomeness and the wailing, both of which were plainer here than they had been at the foot of the steps. His first duty, as planned long ahead, was to find and seize any papers which might seem of vital importance, especially those portentous documents found by Charles so long ago behind the picture in Olney Court. As he searched, he perceived now how stupendous a task the final unravelling would be, for file on file was stuffed with papers in curious hands and bearing curious designs, so that months or even years might be needed in a thorough deciphering and editing. Once he found 3 large packets of letters with Prague and Racker's postmarks, and in writing clearly recognisable as Orne's and Hutchinson's, all of which he took with him as part of the bundle to be removed in his valise. At last, in a locked mahogany cabinet once gracing the Ward home, Willett found the batch of old Curwen papers, recognising them from the reluctant glimpse Charles had granted him so many years ago. The youth had evidently kept them together, very much as they had been when first he found them, since all the titles recalled by the workmen were present, except the papers addressed to Orne and Hutchinson, and the cipher with its key. Willett placed the entire lot in his valise and continued his examination of the files. Since young Ward's immediate condition was the greatest matter at stake, the closest searching was done amongst the most obviously recent matter, and in this abundance of contemporary manuscript one very baffling oddity was noted. The oddity was the slight amount in Charles's normal writing, which indeed included nothing more recent than 2 months before. On the other hand, there were literally reams of symbols and formulae, historical notes and philosophical comment in a crabbed penmanship, obviously identical with the ancient script of Joseph Curwen, though of undeniable modern dating. Plainly a part of the latter-day programme had been a sedulous imitation of the old wizard's writing, which Charles seemed to have carried to a marvellous state of perfection. Of any third hand which might have been Alan's, there was not a trace. If he had indeed come to be the leader, he must have forced young Ward to act as his amanuensis. In this new material, one mystic formula, or rather a pair of formulae, recurred so often that Willett had it by heart before he had half finished his quest. It consisted of two parallel columns, the left-hand one surmounted by the archaic symbol called Dragon's Head, and used in almanacs to indicate the ascending node, and the right-hand one headed by a corresponding sign of Dragon's Tail, or descending node. The appearance of the whole was something like this, and almost unconsciously the Doctor realized that the second half was no more than the first written symbolically backward, with the exception of the final monosyllables and of the odd name Yog-Sothoth, which he had come to recognize under various spellings from other things he had seen in connection with this horrible matter. The formulae were as follows, exactly so, as Willett is abundantly able to testify, and the first one struck an odd note of uncomfortable latent memory in his brain, which he recognized later when reviewing the events of that horrible Good Friday of the previous year. Yaya Nugrath. Yog-Sothoth, heeth Elgab, fe aeth yw dog, ugath, oth grod aeth ei. Abe elia, Yog-Sothoth, nugar nung aia, zero. So haunting were these formulae, and so frequently did he come upon them, that before the Doctor knew it, he was repeating them under his breath. Eventually, however, he felt he had secured all the papers he could digest to advantage for the present, hence resolved to examine no more till he could bring the sceptical alieness en masse for an ampler and more systematic raid. He had still to find the hidden laboratory, so leaving his valise in the lighted room, he emerged again into the black, noisome corridor, whose vaulting echoed ceaseless with that dull and hideous whine. The next few rooms he tried were all abandoned, or filled only with the crumbling boxes and ominous-looking leaden coffins, but impressed him deeply with the magnitude of Joseph Kirwan's original operations. He thought of the slaves and seamen who had disappeared, of the graves which had been violated in every part of the world, and of what the final raiding party must have seen, and then he decided it was better not to think any more. Once a great stone staircase mounted at his right, and he deduced that this must have reached to one of the Kirwan outbuildings, perhaps the famous stone edifice with the high, stilt-like windows, provided the steps he had descended had led from the steep-roofed farmhouse. Suddenly the walls seemed to fall away ahead, and the stench and the wailing grew stronger. Willett saw that he had come upon a vast open space, so great that his torchlight would not carry across it, and as he advanced he encountered occasional stout pillars supporting the arches of the roof. After a time, he reached a circle of pillars grouped like the monoliths of Stonehenge, with a large carved altar at the base of three steps in the centre, and so curious were the carvings on the altar that he approached to study them with his electric light. But when he saw what they were, he shrank away shuddering, and did not stop to investigate the dark stains which discoloured the upper surface and had spread down the sides in occasional thin lines. Instead he found the distant wall, and traced it as it swept round in a gigantic circle perforated by occasional black doorways, and indented by a myriad of shallow cells with iron gratings, and wrist and ankle bonds on chains fastened to the stone of the concave rear masonry. His cells were empty, but still the horrible odour and the dismal moaning continued more insistent now than ever, and seemingly varied at time with a sort of slippery thumping. And that's where we leave the good Doctor for today. Thanks for listening. Do tell your friends if you enjoy the show. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk